to the Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee on Tuesday, April 14th. A couple of announcements for folks in the room. We have some senators that need to get back to their committees, so we're going to do the work sessions first. Then we're going to finish up the public hearing on Senate Bill 80. It is carried over from the April 9th agenda. And as I had mentioned before, we had people who signed up that we didn't have time to hear them, so we're going to hear their testimony. We had about 10 people signed up. So we are not taking more testimony today verbally, but if you have written testimony, you can submit it. The record is going to stay open until the end of close of business on Friday. We may be having another public hearing or work session. We do have those scheduled, so you can check the agenda. Just wanted to let folks know about that, and then we will be also hearing Senate Bill 743 and Senate Bill 942. So first, we're going to open up a work session. I'm not going to do that first because we have the senators here. So first, we're going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 334. We have to close that door because it's really noisy. So Senate Bill 334. Beth, if you can give us an overview, please. Remind the committee.
Senate Bill 334 authorizes the state treasurer to issue Article 11D bonds at the request of the Department of Energy to finance the acquisition and operation of renewable energy, electricity generation, and transmission facility lines. You do have a -2 amendment in front of you to consider, and there is a no revenue, and a fiscal statement was issued on this bill.
Okay, thank you. And we have Senator Walker here. This was a bill. This is her bill, and she's here to talk about the amendments.
Thank you.
With her drafter. I don't know how you manage that.
You know, you just say nice things to them, and they show up. But unfortunately, I meant to say a bad thing, but we'll wait. Vicki Walker, State Senator, District 7. Thank you, Madam Chair. If you remember previously when we had a hearing on this bill, I wanted to use a little used or never used provision in the Oregon Constitution that it was enacted in 1932, Article 11D, and it was used to, it was actually passed for the use of public hydropower. However, with the creative talents of the man sitting next to me, Dave Hendricks from Legislative Council, last session we put together a plan that could use the Article 11D purpose for other things, and in this instance I wanted to purchase transmission lines for getting all this renewable energy to the grid. Well, as you know, at the last hearing we had a Department of Justice opinion that said we were a little bit broad with the way we had written the bill, so we have -2 amendments before you. There is a -2 because the -1 had a word of missing. You know, that two-letter word can really get you sometimes. But my eagle eye as a court reporter, I am going to just straighten them out right now. I even caught the copy editors off guard in Legislative Council, and there's the word of added back to line 19 after the word purpose. It was missing in the draft. You do see an email from the Secretary of the Senate indicating that that does not constitute the need for having a new fiscal and revenue statement drafted. So we are good to go should you be happy with it. So I'm going to have Mr. Hendricks talk about what the amendment does and how we changed it. You know that I was wanting to buy the transmission lines down in Christmas Valley. Darn if someone else got to it before we did. Had we passed this bill last session like I wanted to, we would have beat them to the punch. But at least it's owned by a co-op. And so I think that the Department of Energy is going to be able to work with the co-op to increase the capacity of those lines. As you know, Madam Chair, adequate transmission capacity for the region over the next 25 years is a goal of the Western Governors Association. It was one of the goals we determined that was important to becoming energy independent in the West, and I participated in the Clean and Diversified Energy Advisory Committee for 18 months that was part of the Western Governors Association. And as you also may know, the federal government is hot on the trail of doing transmission projects across the country, so I want to make sure Oregon has the opportunity to participate in that. Particularly, I do not want the federal government taking over the role of siting transmission lines. So let me tell you that what I want to do with this bill is what I wanted to do before. It sets up the framework and the structure for us to sell bonds if we want to develop transmission projects. It does not borrow the money now. It just simply sets up the framework and takes that piece of the Constitution and makes it workable. So if I could turn it over to Mr. Hendricks to give you a brief explanation of how that's done in the amendment, that would be great.
Thank you. Mr. Hendricks.
Chair Dingfeld, members of the committee, Dave Hendricks from the Legislative Council's office. These amendments were drafted based on comments made by the Department of Justice, and they've gone back and forth a couple of times to where we're both comfortable with them. The most significant, the two most significant things that they do, A, down on lines 14 through 17, the original bill would have specified specifically that these funds would be used for certain renewable energy type projects. And the Department of Justice indicated, and I believe correctly, that a better approach would be simply to say that for the purposes of this bill, which is, again, just setting up the statutory structure for how the bonds would be issued and how they would work, that we substitute language that indicates that the bonds can be issued for any of the reasons for which that particular constitutional provision authorizes the use of funds. Because you should remember there was some discussion with the Department of Justice about what type of facilities you could finance with the funds, given that the original constitutional amendment was so focused on hydropower. So we did that. We expanded it out so if we could have a discussion at some later date, perhaps at the time they talk about issuing bonds, whether or not it's appropriate uses under the provision. But at this point, all that the law will say is that here's the mechanism for issuing them for the purposes specified in the Constitution. And then the other thing on the second page on lines 3 through 9, there are provisions that basically allow some flexibility for switching the monies between the various funds. Those are the two really significant things that the amendments do.
Okay. Are there any questions for Mr. Hendricks?
I don't have a problem.
Or for Senator Walker?
Just an authority.
Okay.
All right. Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the opportunity to come here. I think this is a a great bill to set us up in the future should we need to implement these bonds. And just a reminder that Article 11D bonds are general obligation bonds, and they're paid back either through the lottery or the general fund. So once we get this set in place, we're ready to go. We won't need to come back to the legislature to get this structure in place, and I think we're well on our way to taking care of some of our transmission problems.
Okay. Well, seeing no other questions then, we are in a work session. Mr. Vice Chair, I will entertain
move to
a motion.
Adopt the Dash 2 amendments dated April 14th, 09.
Okay, Senator Atkinson moves to adopt the Dash 2 amendments dated March 14th, 2009. Is there any discussion? Okay, is there any objection? Seeing none, amendments are adopted.
I move Senate Bill 334 as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation, and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Okay, Senator Atkinson moves Senate Bill 334 as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation, and that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection? Seeing none, the motion passes, and the bill is sent as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means. I will not assign a carrier because that will occur down in Ways and Means. So thank you, Senator Walker. Thank you, committee members. With that, I will close the work session on Senate Bill 334. Okay. We have another work session following on this from another member here in the room, Senate Bill 545. Beth, if you can provide us with a reminder on that one as well, please.
Yes, Madam Chair and committee members, Senate Bill 545 directs, you have a Dash 1 amendment in front of you, it directs ODF&W to study fish hatcheries and impacts of pathogens on fish and hatchery operations and financial pro forma statements that compare the state-owned hatchery's costs with the cost of purchasing Desert Springs Trout Farm. Directs the Legislative Fiscal Office to assist with computing costs and directs ODF&W to submit a report to the legislature.
Okay. Welcome, Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Frank Morse, State Senator from District 8, representing Albany and Corvallis areas of Linn and Benton counties. Thank you very much for hearing this bill today and putting it into a work session. Very respectful of your time and the other big issues that you have today. The amendment that you have before you essentially replaces the bill. It focuses on two major areas. One is an analysis of pathogen in hatcheries vis-a-vis trout and salmon hatcheries in ODF&W and production of trout in the Desert Springs hatchery. And the second part of the bill that begins on page 2, line 7, is the part that deals with the financial analysis of the potential benefits of acquiring Desert Springs. And the context for this is, and the goal that I would have, is hopefully we could find a way to make a self-liquidating acquisition, that the benefits of producing fish in this very, very unusual, and it's a one-of-a-kind in the state of Oregon, that has the volume of water consistent year-round, 60-degree temperature, and what that would mean to the benefit of the sport angling industry in Oregon would be profound. Senator Atkinson, I know, is a fellow fly fisherman and understands these issues very well. So, Madam Chair, essentially the financial part of the bill is the creation of a business plan, in effect using the vernacular of the business world, to model existing costs versus prospective costs if Desert Springs was a part of the state assets. So I very much appreciate the opportunity to bring this bill forward, and we'll answer any questions.
Okay. Any questions for the senator? No? Okay. Thank you, and okay. We do have the fiscal on this, so obviously it's going down to Ways
right.
and Means.
Right.
All right. Thank you. I will take a motion. We are in work
Madam
session.
Madam Chair, I'd move the -1 amendments dated April 1st, 2009.
Nine. That's a typo.
Thank you.
It is 2009. Senator Atkinson moves to adopt the -1 amendments as are dated April 1st, 2009. Is there any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, the motion passes.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 545 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation, that the recommendation be and recommend that it be referred.
Referred. It doesn't have a current referral right now.
Wear your glasses. To the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Okay. Senator Atkinson moves Senate Bill 545 as amended with the -1s to the floor with the due pass recommendation and recommend that it be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Is there any discussion? Senator Boquist?
I'm conceptually in support of this. Don't really have a problem with it. The fiscal, you know, raises an eyebrow. And while I've told the good Senator Morris I'm in support of his conceptual idea, I think in light of my previous votes where I voted no on things with large fiscals until we see how it comes out of downstairs, I'll be a no vote, but I do support the concept. I just want Ways and Means to know that they need to analyze this amongst a host of other priorities.
I appreciate that, Senator Boquist, and since I'm on that committee, I will certainly make sure that it gets communicated to my colleagues. Any other discussion? Okay. Seeing none, should we take a vote? Roll call.
Senator
Boquist?
No.
Senator
Pazonki?
Aye.
Senator Hatch?
Aye.
Vice Chair Atkinson?
Yes.
Chair Dinkfelder?
Aye. That motion carries, and again, we don't need a carrier since it's going down to the Ways and Means Committee. Okay, we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 545. We're going to open up a work session on Senate Bill, let's see, is this, no, let's do, I think I'm going to do 676 first. So open up a work session on Senate Bill 676. And Senator Pazonski, you wanted to say a few comments on that?
Yeah, Madam Chair, this is 676, is the industrial hemp bill that we've heard testimony on. It's ready for our work session. Unfortunately, the fiscal impact that was turned in by the Department of Ag seemed to be contemplating that they would go into get-ready mode, specifically that they would have a program ready to run if and when the federal government allowed states to actually exercise the right of having industrial hemp recreated in farming in their various states. Because it is still uncertain as to what the federal government will be doing, I'm working with legislative counsel to clarify on the bill that there would be no duty by the Department of Ag to actually implement any program that really can't be implemented until we get the sign-off and approval by the Fed. So with that, I'm asking the chair to carry this over maybe for till Tuesday of next week.
Okay.
And that should give us enough time to have everything, plus mm-hmm. any fiscal rewrite that would need to be done.
Okay. Okay. So we...
That'd be the 21st.
Yeah, I think so. So we are in work session, and I'm just going to say that we are going to carry this bill over, Senate Bill 676, until April 21st for a work session. We'll repost that as well, so check the agenda. With that, I will close the work session on Senate Bill 676. Now I will open up a work session on Senate Bill 103. Last work session.
Madam Chair and committee members, Senate Bill 103 authorized the Environmental Quality Commission to establish a schedule of fees for registration. You have a dash 5 amendment in front of you that, in addition to establishing the schedule of fees for registration, it also authorizes the commission to establish a fees for reporting of any class of air contamination sources that is required to obtain a state or federal operating permit. There's also someone from the department here.
Yes, he miraculously showed up at the stand. So we have Andy Ginsberg from DEQ that's going to walk us through the dash fives. That's correct. And as you recall, we've had a hearing on this bill before. And Andy, if you can explain to us what the dash fives do in detail, appreciate that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Andy Ginsberg. I'm the Air Quality Administrator at DEQ. And just to remind you, Senate Bill 103 provides an alternative to traditional permitting. It's a more efficient mechanism, especially for small businesses, so that we can register them rather than permit them. The existing statute, ORS 468A.050, is a registration process, but it doesn't have a fee associated with it. So for any programs that have a cost, we're forced into using a permit, which does have a fee, and this is just an alternative, lower-cost alternative to permitting. At the hearing, several concerns were raised, and we've addressed them all in the Dash 5 amendments. I'm pleased to report that all the stakeholders that commented during the hearing or talked to me after the hearing have agreed that these amendments address their concerns. And I'll just walk you through them briefly, Madam Chair. On page 1, starting on line 17, we have new Section 3 that's added. Section 3 was the in the original bill added the fee to the registration process. The changes really on line 17 through 21, where we narrowed the scope so that to clarify that this is really an off-ramp to permitting. So the language is a little bit complicated to follow, but what it says is that first you have to be subject to permitting, and then you have to choose as an option to be registered instead of permitting, and only then can a fee apply. So the point here was that we can't register sources that otherwise wouldn't be permitted just to charge them a fee. So this narrows our authority so that we can only charge a fee as an alternative to permitting. And then if we move on to Section 4 on the next page, starting on line 6, that's all new with this amendment. And the purpose here is to clarify if a company already has a permit. The concern was that we wouldn't want to have a permit fee and a registration fee apply, so this makes it basically one or the other, with the one exception that if we have a reporting requirement that's not otherwise covered by their permit fee, we can charge a registration fee to cover the cost of reporting. So that is in Section 4A. We can establish a fee just for reporting if you're a permitted facility. In 4B, before we do that, we have to ensure that we've looked at your fees holistically to make sure that your current permit fee doesn't already cover that cost. And in 4C, if we establish that fee for reporting, it has to be collected as part of and together with your regular permit fees. So, Madam Chair, with those amendments, all of the stakeholders are satisfied with this bill.
Okay. Any questions of Andy while I have him up here? Mr. Ginsberg? Otherwise, we are in work session.
Madam Chair.
Hold on. Did you either of you have any questions while Andy's up here?
No, I'm thoroughly confused, but that's okay.
Well, do you want, I mean, this is a time, Senator Boquist, so if you have questions.
So I think I need to read a little bit more.
Okay.
I'll go ahead and proceed.
Okay. And maybe Andy can spend some time with you on that. Okay.
Madam Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 5 amendments that are dated April 13, 2009, into Senate Bill 103.
Okay. Senator Prezonsky moves to adopt the Dash 5 amendments dated April 13, 2009. Is there any discussion? Senator Buckles.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I'll be a no vote, but I would like Andy to come see me because I think if I understand it, I might change my vote later.
Okay. All right.
I don't want to hold it out there.
Okay. So, actually, we'll do a roll call if we can.
Senator Buckles?
No.
Senator Buzonski?
Aye.
Senator Hatt?
Aye.
Vice Chair Atkinson?
Yes.
Chair Nate Boger?
Aye. With that, the motion carries, and I'll accept another motion.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 103 as amended with the dash fives to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator Przanski moves Senate Bill 103 as amended with the dash fives to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? So noted.
Sort of the same thing.
Senator Boquist. Okay, we'll.
Nope.
Yep.
No. Go ahead.
Yeah. Okay. Would the clerk call the roll, please?
Senator Boquist?
No.
Senator Przanski?
Aye.
Senator Hatt?
Aye.
Vice Chair Atkinson?
No.
Aye. Okay, with that, the motion passes, and I will carry the bill. And with that, we will close the work session on Senate Bill 103. And we will open up the continuation of the public hearing on Senate Bill 80. We have the sign-up list from last time. And just to be fair, we were taking testimony at 2 minutes for the hearing last week. So to be fair, we're going to be having a two-minute timer and ask everybody to please watch Beth, who has a very high-tech sign, professional high-tech sign here that she'll flash in front of you. So we apologize that we couldn't get everybody last time. We really appreciate the fact that you could come back. And we'll start with...
I will just say for the record there were some people that were not able to testify, and they did submit written testimony, and the members have that in front of them, that they were unable to come back today.
So you have that in front of you, members. And then we have a couple people, let's see.
Replacement
okay.
for themselves.
So first we'll hear, I'm going to call you up four at a time. That doesn't mean you're all on the same side or all connected. But it just for ease of getting through, since we have two other public hearings after this. So I'll call up Art Crino, if I'm saying that right, and Don Paul Cadwalder.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Joe Esmond and, I'm sorry, I'm having
Bill
a hard
time.
Bill Hoyt. Sorry if I'm not saying your name right, but please, if you've written testimony, you can hand it to the committee staff, and then also if you can state your name for the record. We'll start with you since you're so prompt, and welcome back.
Madam Chair and other members of the committee, my name is Art Crino from Tigard. On the farm back in Milwaukee, Oregon, I developed a healthy respect for carbon dioxide because of our greenhouses. So after graduating from Oregon State in electrical engineering and became a specialist in steam power plants, I was assigned to Los Angeles, where we built 12 plants in the course of 10 years. And that was when the smog in Los Angeles was at its very peak. And so we had many conversations on this topic, but carbon dioxide never came up because it's not a pollutant. So when it showed up in House Bill 3543 in the last session, I was in a state of shock. So that's why I'd like you to watch that 11-minute DVD that I presented you called Unstoppable Solar Cycles, where those two scientists show, in my opinion anyhow, that Earth's temperature is primarily driven by the sun. Now, they're not the voice crying in the wilderness, because on the back side of that is a petition signed by 32,000 scientists, 9,000 PhDs, who say in the first paragraph that we should not implement the 1997 Kyoto Protocol. In the second paragraph, we need more greenhouse, or we need more carbon dioxide, not less. There's a billion people in this world who are just barely getting by, and it would be a tragedy to cut it down, because in the last 50 years, carbon dioxide has increased in the state by 22% 32%, 22%. That is produced 16% more vegetation, and if that were to diminish, or it would be a tragedy for the people that are just barely hanging on. I want to thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you for coming today, and thank you for coming back. I appreciate that. Whoever would like to go next?
Yes, Madam Chairman, board members. My name is Don Cadwallader. I'm from Toledo, Oregon. I work in a mill. My main concern is if these laws are enacted, the results on the industry is going to be catastrophic. What we're going to do is export our jobs and the pollution to China. There's so much capacity in the network now that if we shut down the mills in Oregon, not including paper mills, but the steel mill, that those jobs are gone. In my mill alone would be 400 jobs. That affects the community big time. That also affects the 100 or so trucks that bring paper, waste paper, chips to our mill, and the paper that goes out. How are we going to pay for an additional 400, maybe 600 people that are going to go on unemployment, food stamps, lose their houses, lose their dreams? China's just sitting there waiting to absorb another mill. The mill that was shut down in North Bend, they picked up that whole machine and sent it to Southeast Asia and set it up. We can't compete with that. They don't have the environmental laws that we do. There's no way we can compete. In my eyes, this law is too extreme. Thank you very much for your time, ma'am.
Thank you. Thanks for coming here today and sharing your thoughts.
Madam Chair, committee members, I'm Bill Hoyt. I'm the president-elect of the Oregon Cattlemen's Association, and I'm going to echo some of the sentiments just heard. This is a costly proposal that sacrifices jobs and will render Oregon business uncompetitive as it relates to domestic and international competition. Two utilities have initially estimated the hard cap to Oregon, the only carbon-free jurisdiction in the world, that would cost over $11.5 billion. In today's paper, Pacific Corp estimates that the increase in electricity costs will be 17%. This will impact manufacturing, agriculture, all phases of small business in Oregon. Oregon is less than 1% of the nation's CO2 emissions and only 5% of the western states' emissions. Oregon's forests already sequester up to half of Oregon's emissions. And even if we turned off all the lights, shut down all the plants, stopped driving all of our cars, it would not create a blip on the global climate change radar screen, and Oregon simply cannot do this alone. We support CO2 reduction, but in a well-planned and measured way. We think here on my operation, I ranch in Douglas and Lane counties. We feel that retrofitting our vehicles would cost up to $10,000 per. We have members of the Oregon Cattlemen's Association who estimate that retrofitting their vehicles would cost up to $350,000 in certain operations. We feel that it's important that you keep in mind the impact on Oregon businesses, Oregon agriculture, and allow us to maintain a competitive nature. And thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you for coming here today. Appreciate you all. Thank you, gentlemen. Joe is standing on the side, and I'm also going to call up Tom Wolf and Henry Kramer. If you can come up, please. And then we have about six more folks after that. Thanks for coming back, Joe.
Thanks for having me.
Why don't you get started?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and the committee. First of all, I want to thank you for all your work. I know it ain't easy. I am Joe Esmond with the IBW 48. I'm also speaking this afternoon on behalf of the Oregon State Building Trades, representing about 30,000 people who work in construction, and I'll be speaking for our contractors also. We urge a no vote on Senate Bill 80. We feel that the carbon cap that raises energy costs and will affect the jobs. And right now, we don't need to have that kind of problem. Our people work in lots of manufacturing plants where they provide their family with health care and a pension and very good wages. I also gave you a handout there of what we have done over the years to get ready for this kind of situation. 1,300 people trained in solar in the state of Oregon. 600 people worked on windmills. We are working on the wind power, energy efficiency. I've been tracking this stuff for about 7 or 8 years. I am part of the Energy Trust of Oregon on a Conservation Advisory Council. I have gone to our federal people over the years and saying, and they have agreed that this fruit is the lowest hanging fruit that we can achieve the carbon reduction and get and wean ourselves away from foreign oil too. So I'll try to be brief for your sake. I will take any questions if you like.
Okay, thank you.
For the record, my name is Henry Kramer. I represent the Oregon Bus Project. Chair Dingfeld and members of the committee, I'm here to testify to urge you to support the amended version of Senate Bill 80. As a vehicle for hands-on democracy, we generally work at the Bus Project in bringing young people into the democratic process, and so I wanted to address this bill and the work done by this bill from a youth perspective. From the perspective of Oregon's youth, the effort to reduce greenhouse gases, it's more than a good idea. It's a fundamental necessity for our future quality of life. About last month in late March and early April, 12,000 young people converged on Washington, D.C. to advocate for a green economy and power shift. Oregon was one of the biggest blocks of that. Oregon's young people want to build a green energy economy. We want our jobs to come from that kind of economy. And we think Senate Bill 80 will help to build that infrastructure by encouraging the entrepreneurs to come to Oregon to work in clean energy. But we're not just thinking about our future paychecks. We're thinking about living here and working here in the future and raising our families here in the future. And we don't want to live in a state that doesn't look like the state that we know and love today. I mean, everybody in this room will feel the ravages of global warming, but none more so than the next generation, the generation after mine and after that. We don't want to see our farms go sterile. We don't want to see our forests get burned in wildfires. If we continue on today's track, we're going to inherit a very different state than the one we know today. We'll see more floods, and like I said, more wildfires, reduced agriculture, and progressively higher energy prices. According to a recent study by the University of Oregon, each family in our state will face nearly $2,000 in increased climate costs if we do nothing, and that's just in 10 years, and those estimates are conservative. From the perspective of Oregon's young people, doing nothing is simply not an option. I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today, and I urge you in the strongest terms possible to enact this bill.
Okay, thank you. Thanks for coming back, gentlemen. Appreciate it. And Tom Wolf, is Tom Wolf here? I don't see him. Okay. So we'll call it Craig Smith. Craig, John Ledger, John here. Let's see, John. And Brian Dougherty.
There's a bunch of people outside.
Okay. Welcome.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Craig Smith, Vice President of the Northwest Food Processors Association. Chair Dingfelder and members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to testify on SB 80. I'm here in opposition. And I'm going to cut through my testimony, but I want to tell you that there's a lot at stake here. We represent 17,000 family wage jobs in the state of Oregon. We're part of the stability of the economy of the state, and we definitely want to be a part of the solution to all the issues that the state is facing over the next 50 years. There's a couple things that came out of the hearing last week that I'd like to address up front. There was some confusion over what this bill in the Dash 3 amendments contains and whether or not it really contains a hard cap. And when you look at the bill, there's actually three sections that cap emissions. They're all at the same level, but Section 1 requires the state executive agencies to meet the goals in ORS 468A-205. Those are the now voluntary aspirational goals that were adopted a couple of years ago. Section 5 requires that the PUC develop a plan for electric and natural gas companies, and that plan shall meet those emission levels in that section as well. And then in Section 9, there's a stationary source cap on industry that requires direct emissions for facilities that emit over 10,000 tons to meet the goals if certain conditions apply. And so there was some question about whether the bill had hard caps. We believe it does. And then there was a question on whether or not there were off-ramps. State agencies are offered no off-ramps at all in this bill. The electric and gas utilities have the ability to produce a report, but have no way to escape the mandates of the limits And the stationary sources, which would be my industry, have a potential off-ramp as long as the climate advisory policy that's created by this bill determines that we are not necessary as an industry to meet those goals, which we think is doubtful, but there is a potential there, and also that there is a cost-effective and technologically they're infeasible. So those are the two things. I think that the second piece that we have in here we're talking about.
Do you have written testimony that you've submitted?
I do.
Okay. So I'm going to have to cut you off just to be fair, because that's what we did to everyone else. So since we have your written testimony, we can read through that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Brian?
Good afternoon, Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee. Brian Doherty here testifying on behalf of the Western States Petroleum Association. And to give you some context between today and Thursday, I'm going to try and tell you how the Western States Petroleum Association is trying to fit into that dress that Ms. Durbin mentioned last Thursday. First of all, right now these companies have bought 11 ethanol terminals that have come up on the market. We are blending 11 billion gallons of ethanol nationally. We are working on numerous renewable energy products and deals to move forward in this direction. As I've testified before, we are blending, pursuant to federal law, over 11 billion gallons of ethanol. We're blending biodiesel. We're required to blend 22 billion gallons of new biodiesel over the next few years. So we are moving forward. There's nothing standing still here despite this bill. What I'm concerned about is that this bill is a cap and tax, not a cap and trade. I have testified before that we think the best way to try and get to these very ambitious 2020 goals, or to fit into that very tight 2020 prom dress, is to use a cap and trade mechanism that finally gets you to a market mechanism. There are other market mechanisms. We have transportation fuels now that are going to be not commercially available until probably 2015. The WCI has used 2015 as the date for this to come forward in their plan. Yet we are talking about fuels that are not commercially available today. If you put a cap on a product that does not have commercially available alternatives, you've got a cap and tax, and that's the problem that's coming up. Section 7 also has a grant of authority with the power to adopt rules immediately or a hard cap on the transportation section. We don't believe you've had any conversation going on about low carbon fuel standards, carbon tax, any of these things that gives you as legislators the ability to make a decision about what's the best course. I think you ought to plan ahead and look at the choices you have over this interim and choose it in 2011. What is the best direction you can take for the 2020 goals? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Doherty. And I just want to clarify for the record that the bill on the low carbon fuel standard is in the House committee on the other side. So I do know they've been having here. We haven't had the hearings in here yet, but there is a House bill.
Correct.
Which I'm sure.
Correct. It's another
aware.
Mechanism of reducing greenhouse gases.
Great. Thank you. Mr. Ledger.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm trying to purge my mind of Brian in a prom dress, and it's but we'll do it.
Yeah, it's not a pretty sight, I know.
It is not. You should have in front of you a piece of paper. It's headed scope. I asked for it to be passed out. And what it does is it shows you very quickly who gets affected by the industrial side of this. The SB 80 and SB the dash 3s, there's a different threshold. 25,000 gets you in, should be 25,000. Get you in, we've got an extra zero there, on the SB 80, 10,000 per year gets you in on the dash 3s. I've never seen anything go as low as 10,000 a year. It's never discussed anywhere. That encompasses companies that have a footprint, an Oregon footprint of about, under the SB original one, of 37 one-thousandths of 1% of the state footprint up to 1%. Under the dash 3s, it's 14 one-thousandths of 1%. First one affects about 30 sources, second one about 58, and if you look down to the bottom, if they reduce their emissions down to the caps, you'd save about 1.7% of the state emissions. That's what you gain from that whole piece on the industrial side. The second piece I'd like to say is we had great concerns about the initial SB 80 because it punted the whole issue of regulation from the agency, from the legislature, to the DEQ. This punts it in two pieces. First, it punts it to this kind of a troika that's formed of three people, and if any two of those decide, somewhat subjectively, that the DEQ should regulate these sources, that automatically trips the DEQ into regulatory function. Again, it completely bypasses the functions of the legislature. Further, although there are a lot of considerations, things to consider, things to analyze, on the DEQ side, there is nothing that prohibits them from doing a cap and trade, cap, carbon tax, whatever they'd like to do. It's wide open. Last, I'd like to say there are a lot of things in this at the front section that deal with analytics that are good, and they should have been done a year or 2 years ago, and they're worth doing now as far as what the economic effects are, and we should not end up throwing that kind of work out.
Thank you.
Thank
gentlemen.
You.
Questions? Yes, yes, Senator Brzozinski.
Craig, I just want to go over your testimony on Section 1.
Yes.
I read that it says that basically those agencies shall create the plans. It doesn't say anything about implementing the plans. It says to create. Do you disagree with that? Line 8, page 1.
It says they have to meet.
It says they shall create a plan in order to meet the greenhouse gas emission reduction goals. And I suppose you could read that either way. I read that as a requirement.
Well, I am too. It says they have to create the plan. It doesn't implement the plan. It just creates a plan
for the agencies to meet the goal.
All right. And then let's go over to page 5, lines 25 on section 5. So I'm just pondering when I look at line 29 where it says the plan shall meet these different emissions. Then it says if the commission, and then continue on the next page, believes that the meeting the goals would not be technologically feasible or would not or would cause extraordinary economic hardships, they have to go through this process. So is it your interpretation, because of the way it's worded, that they still have to actually, quote-unquote, meet the plan and provide the report?
Yes.
Okay, and I would do the same thing, I assume, on Section 9?
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay, any other questions? All right, thank you, gentlemen. And the last folks that we had signed up was Barbara Wilson, Marianne Fitzgerald, and Marianne Haynes. So nobody's here, huh?
We'll give it a second. They may be outside. Yeah.
Barbara Wilson, Marianne Fitzgerald, or Marianne Haynes. Here comes Marianne.
There's like 25.
Yeah, is everyone outside the door? Is that?
No, there's a TV outside.
Okay.
Yeah, overflow.
I didn't know we had overflow
it's
over there.
In here.
Okay. So if Barbara or Marianne are out there, please come on in. We'll get started with Marianne.
Good morning, Chair Dingfelder, committee members. My name is Marianne Haynes. I'm with the Oregon Business Association. OBA believes that we are moving into a carbon-constrained future and that the state can and should take steps now in order to prepare the state and Oregon companies to be in a better position for this eventuality. There's a lot of agreement around the things that we can do. I participated in the work group that met for many, many hours on this issue, and I think there was a lot of agreement around the need to do planning and scoping, to look at offsets, to find a way to put the interagency coordination together so that we can deal with how reductions will be allocated among sectors. We really need to do these steps and evaluate the cost of what ensuring greenhouse gas reductions will be and what's possible. I think concerns about cost and business competitiveness are legitimate, and we need to take a look at that. In the work groups, it was pretty evident that there were a lot of questions about how we move forward and what that means, but there were few answers at that point. So from our perspective, should we move forward? Absolutely, but we need to do so thoughtfully. It's time to prepare the state for a carbon-constrained future and for a comprehensive climate policy that we believe will be coming at a federal level. So we look forward to continuing to work with you on that and finding a way to move the state forward, do it thoughtfully, and mitigate against potential cost impacts. Thank you.
Thank you, Marianne. Appreciate you coming back. And if Marianne or Barbara are still here. Okay. Any questions for Marianne? Okay. Thank you so much. Okay. With that, there was a request to have the agencies come up that are identified in this in the bill, and so we've asked them to come up here today. So we're going to ask.
Don't hesitate. Come on up.
Yep. DEQ. We have Dick Peterson. Mike Greeney from Department of Energy. Is Mike here? He's supposed to be here. And
ODOT. Margie Lifsey from
ODOT. Okay. And Lee
yep.
Beyer, PUC. I thought I saw Lee. Yep, he's hiding in the back. Okay, is Mike Groening hiding back there and I can't see him?
He may be coming in. Why don't we get started?
Okay. All right, Dick, I'm going to ask you to start. What I wanted to do was ask the agencies for their comment on the dash threes, and then we'll take any questions before we close the public hearing on this. And thank you, gentlemen. I know you're all, and ladies, I know you're all very busy.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dick Peterson. I'm the director of the Department of Environmental Quality. And in terms of commenting on Dash 3 amendments, we've looked at them, and what I would say is that we're more than willing to continue to move forward and look at ways to work in this future carbon-constrained world, and I think the Dash 3 amendments provide a platform for us to do that. What I would say is that what's critically important is that when we think about Dash 3 amendments and moving forward is that it's incumbent upon the state to ensure that we don't disadvantage the businesses and the work that's done, that's going on in the state right now, and we have to develop a program that's going to recognize not only the good work that has been done, but captures it in a way so that however we move forward, we don't lose that, and we don't lose the opportunity for businesses to take credit for what they've done moving forward. And I see this as a planning process to make sure we're nesting all of the different sectors that are contributing to carbon in a way that we can think for the state as we move forward.
Okay. Well, then I'll have all of you go first, and then there may be some questions. Mr. Beyer, thanks for coming.
Madam Chair, for the record, Lee Beyer, Chair of the Oregon Public Utility Commission, and I would echo Dick's comments. We've looked at this. There are some changes that we would, technical fixes that we would suggest if you're going to move forward in this to make those. And we share the same kinds of concerns for the electrical and natural gas customers and realize the goals there, and we need to make it. Part of this is, as many of you are aware, we do as a normal course of business with our integrated resource plans. It's just a step further along that line, and obviously the discussion on caps and off-ramps and all that are important discussions to have.
Okay. All right. Margie?
Hi, I'm Margie Lipsey from the Oregon Department of Transportation. Director Garrett could not be here today. Again, I would echo the comments that have been said on these amendments. ODOT has been doing a lot of work in this area on climate change, and we support a lot of the concepts in this bill. And we would maybe suggest some technical changes with respect to the timelines and have some questions as what it would take to staff an effort like this for our agency, particularly with Section 7 and 8. So those are the types of things that we're looking into, but as far as the goal of the plan, we're absolutely supportive and understand that there's a need to take action on climate change.
Okay. And David Vandhoff from the governor's office here, and you weren't here in the room, so would you want to come up, David, so if there's any questions as well? I think we'd like to hear from the governor's office, and then we'll open up for questions. No, Mike Groening?
He's on his way.
Okay, Mr. Groening, I guess, is on his way, so we'll stall for a minute.
2 minutes, ma'am. He gets 2 minutes to stall.
It's 2 minutes to stall, and that's it. Yeah, otherwise we're going to close.
Madam Chair, is there a question for me?
Well, if you wanted to, without Mr. Groening here, maybe you can comment from the governor's office on
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I just heard some of the tail end of the comments from these folks, but I don't know if it was already mentioned, but we are meeting tomorrow morning to try and just work through. Again, we've been trying to digest the dash threes, and I think that we think that they're with some you know, technical tweaks that could be in good shape. So we're going to try and get those to the committee tomorrow.
Okay, and I guess Mr. Greeny just came in, so
this place the governor.
Yeah, this is place the governor. Hi, Mr. Greeny. I know you were just testifying another committee, but what I'd ask the agencies to do, if they could comment on the dash threes, and I know that you're meeting with the governor's office in the morning to get all your comments to the committee. But I wanted to give the, since you're named in the bill, we want to make sure you give the opportunity to comment on it.
Yes, Madam Chair, for the record, Mike Groening from Department of Energy, and the dash threes are the same ones we testified on last week, and as I mentioned that, I think this is continues to be progress towards meeting our climate change targets. And I think the bill, with the amendments, has good provisions in it, and we're willing to work on the technical changes that need to be made to get those back to you right away.
Okay. Any questions for the panel? Senator Boquist?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, a series of questions, Madam Chair, and just so you three know, it was me who asked, so that's why I got drug in here. Several sections of here have what we call the exit strategy on it, or the soft landing or whatever, and I'm going to read, I'll just pick one because they're in here. It says, you know, in achieving these standards, achieving these reductions can be done in a way that's cost-effective and technologically feasible. My concern is that statement right there. The reason I don't have a problem talking to Lee back there, because Lee does this with utilities all the time, but we have the three of you, and I guess, Madam, you by proxy, are one of four people. There's four of you who make the determination of what's feasible, what's not in the industries. And as I look at the list of affected people, I got steel mills, food processing plants, cement processing, pulp and paper, hospitals, and we have the Department of Energy in the lead. And, oh, by the way, I have Wachang on here, too. My concern is what expertise do you personally have in determining the economic viability of private sector businesses, and what expertise do your three agencies have in doing that? Now, Lee does this all the time, but he's not the lead agency, and you three, at least Energy's the lead, and the three of you are going to decide whether these industries live or die.
Madam Chair, Senator Boquist, let me mention first that in terms of energy efficiency, cost-effectiveness criteria, that's something that I and my agency deal with every day in a number of areas. We deal with it in our energy tax credit programs, both for individuals and businesses. We deal with it in our energy loan program. We deal with it in grants to state and local buildings as to whether these are good investments that they make in energy efficiency, whether they will pay back or not. So in terms of the technology, in terms of the the same for renewable energy. And most of the measures that, except for sequestration of carbon, that deal with reductions of greenhouse gases involve either energy efficiency or renewable energy. So I think, and in working with businesses, and we work with thousands of businesses every year in our tax credit program, we're well aware of the economic difficulty that businesses are facing, and frankly, the investments in energy efficiency are helping many of those businesses cope with the current economic difficulties that we're facing.
Madam Chair, Senator Boquist, our agency typically deals with industrial sources, as you know, in the permitting aspect, and any time we do any kind of rulemaking in that regard, we have to look at the economic impact of that particular rulemaking. What I will say in regards to this Senate Bill 80-3 is I view DEQ performing under this the same way we do under most rulemaking, is that we wouldn't use our own independence to make the kind of decisions that are critical here. We pull in advisory committees that are made up of not only the really technical experts outside of DEQ, but also the industries that are impacted, so that we have a full understanding of the economic impacts on decision making. And I don't see, in terms of moving forward in decision making, that would be anything different that we would do, that DEQ would do. We wouldn't operate independently. We would look for expertise within the industry that being affected and other industries from agencies or academia or wherever it might be.
I think Dick said exactly what I was going to say, which is we do have our own cost-effective or cost analysis program. We do have our own economic experts, but when it comes to businesses and the private sector, we would work with stakeholders in the private sector, and we would work with our agencies who have expertise in that area. So if it was making decisions about renewable energy, we would defer to DOE, for example, or businesses that could be affected by that.
Follow-up question, Manager.
Follow-up.
And so we all understand. I mean, three of the four voting members that will make the decision are sitting here. It's not the agency. The agencies and private sector are going to be providing advice, but it's basically the two of you and Lee back there. And then your agency director will make the vote that determines the survival of that industry. And you're aware that's in the bill there.
Madam Chair, Senator Boquist, we'll look deep into the bill and ensure if that's there, how we might respond to that. But I will again tell you, if it's me making an independent decision, I personally would not make an independent decision without a full vetting and understanding of those impacts. If I happen to be one of the decision-making points, I mean, that would go to almost anything that I would deal with.
Just for the record, Madam Chair, you are a decision-making point by name in here. The Director of Department of Environmental Quality, Director of State Energy, Director of Transportation, and of course, PUC, I'm fine with because they do this on a routine basis.
Madam Chair, Senator Boquist, I apologize. I knew that DQ was named. What I meant was in terms of the actual decision, what the decision-making process is for the council that I would look at and see how that would straight out. But I knew that we were named in the bill.
Okay. Do you want Lee to come up and respond?
No, I don't need Lee. I mean, Lee does this all the time.
But I would make the same commitment, Madam Chair.
Any other questions?
Nope.
All right. Any questions down this side? All right. Any comments from the Governor's office on that?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you very much. I know you're all busy and appreciate you coming over today. Okay, with that, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 80. And we will now open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 743. And Beth, if you can provide us an overview on that, please.
Senate Bill 743 modifies the provision that allows pre-1995 certified low-impact hydroelectric facilities to qualify for compliance with the Renewable Portfolio Standard if the facility is owned by an electric utility or located in Oregon. There is an amendment in front of you that I think someone's going to come up and explain also.
Okay, we have a panel that we're going to call up. There's actually four people, so actually we have four chairs. There you go. One of you have to make sure and share the mic. So we have Steve Johnson from Central Oregon Irrigation District, Paul Wooden, Community Renewable Energy Association, Mike Kleinsmith, Farmers Irrigation District, and Michael Mason. Michael here from the Confederated Tribes in the Warm Springs.
I'm going to go run in the other hearing room and
okay,
make sure.
See if he's there. Okay. Steve, why don't you get started? Are you going to talk about the Dash 3 amendments? You
know? Yes, I can.
Okay,
I'm
that'd be great.
To do that. Name's Steve Johnson. I'm the manager of Central Oregon Irrigation District. The irrigation district serves 7,000 patrons in Central Oregon, providing irrigation water to over 44,000 acres. In 1989, COID was successful in getting a fully licensed FERC 5.5-meg hydroelectric power plant up and running. Annually, that provides clean, renewable power to, on average, 2,000 homes a year. And in a natural gas equivalent, it's over 9 million pounds of carbon, or 45,000 tons of carbon per year are displaced from not having to be generated from natural gas combustion. Since the plants come online, that represents 87,000 tons of carbon from this one little small plant. So I want to explain Senate Bill 743 to you as briefly as I can. It would allow up to 40 average megawatts a year for small non-utility hydro plants built before 1995 and to have them qualify for renewable energy credits, also known as RECs, that'd be eligible for the Oregon RPS, the Renewable Portfolio Standard. The Oregon RPS already allows pre-95 utility-owned hydro facilities to qualify, and this bill applies that same standard to small-scale, non-utility-owned, certified low-impact projects. The bill limits the amount of these RECs to 40 average megawatts a year and requires that these RECs are generated in Oregon. There's a list of 28 projects attached to my testimony on page 4, representing pre-95 projects that would qualify if this bill passed. It represents several irrigation districts, water districts, Warm Springs Indian Tribe, and municipalities such as the City of Portland and some other small businesses. It would provide, having the RECs qualified under the RPS would provide an economic incentive to reduce environmental impact and extend the life of these projects. I'll give you an example of how COID uses the what its plant generates and then also how it uses its funds. on average is 22,000 RECs, 22 million kilowatt hours are produced. If a REC was $2, that'd be $44,000 a year. What we're able to do with those types of funds is extend the life of the project by being able to plan for long-term projects such as generator repair replacement or overhaul, purchase spare turbines as backup in case there's major damage, and the monies that are left over, which if you qualified for the RECs and had that cash flow, we use surplus cash when it's available from that project now to fund water conservation projects. We also were one of the have a unique relationship with ODFW, a mitigation and enhancement fund for in-stream fishery projects. This project has funded over $1 million to date since 89, and as long as we produce power, we provide cash to ODFW to fill that mission. In addition, to qualify under Senate Bill 743, projects have to be certified as low-impact hydro. Currently, one national organization does that. It's the Low-Impact Hydropower Institute, or LIHI. To get certified, you have to ensure that your project meets high environmental standards. And since LIHI also renews that certification every 5 years. So once you get certified, you want to keep the certification. They're an oversight entity that you want to make sure you comply with. Otherwise, you don't qualify as having a certified facility. Also need to mention, sorry for pausing there, that in order to be eligible in this bill, a non-utility-owned project has to be FERC-licensed or FERC-exempted. An exempted FERC project is similar to a licensed project. The main difference is you don't have large dams and safety issues associated with large dams. This was suggested to be included in the bill by the Oregon Department of Energy, and so we've included that. Second request was also by the Citizens Utility Board, CUB. This amendment limits the eligibility to 40 average megawatts a year from non-utility projects built prior to 1995 to be eligible for the RPS. We agreed with CUB's suggested change, and that's included. So in summary, there are three primary reasons that'd be beneficial for the pre-95 non-utility hydro plants to be able to be certified for RECs under the RPS. I'm trying to think of how many more acronyms I can throw in at one time.
I think you got them all in here.
Okay, thanks. Obtaining low-impact certification benefits the environment. Low-impact certification requires a project maintains that environmental compatibility. To receive your certification, some of the pre-95 projects on that list would have to be modified to become more environmentally compatible. Therefore, there's a benefit. All projects age and must be constantly maintained and improved to continue operation. Providing RPS eligibility to older projects gives the owners of these projects economic incentive and economic means to extend the life of these renewable projects into the future. Older projects are far less expensive to ratepayers than building new ones, but both create the same benefits per megawatt. I again want to refer you to the list of 28 projects. 27 of them produce less than 6 megawatts per year of electricity. And also remind you, also, the bill includes a limit of the RECs eligible to 40 average megawatts a year. Thank you for letting me testify.
Okay. Why don't we take all the testimony, and then we'll take questions. So whoever wants to go next.
Okay, Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to testify in favor of Senate Bill 743. My name is Paul Woodman. I'm Executive Director of the Community Renewable Energy Association. We're an intergovernmental agency that has both government and small industrial members. Our role is to support small-scale community renewable projects in the state of Oregon. Those are defined as 10 megawatts and smaller for hydro, wind, biomass, geothermal, et cetera. Steve has done a good job of describing what the amendment does. Basically, it gives smaller non-utility projects built before 95, most of which are community-owned, the same RPS access given to large utilities. Certification is currently given by the nationally recognized Low-Impact Hydropower Institute. I'd like to point out that this certification is for the older plants. It will actually put them in a better standing than the more modern plants being built that aren't required to get that certification. Unlike large projects located out away from the population centers, a lot of these smaller projects are located in the communities themselves on lower voltage distribution systems. They provide what's known as distributed generation into the smaller lines, helping stiffen the electrical grids there and giving them voltage stability and making them more cost efficient from an electrical viewpoint. Building of new facilities takes a certain type of economics, and the green tags or the RECs really aren't the vehicle that does that. Oregon is favored by having a pretty aggressive program of business energy tax credit programs, Betsy, sustainable energy loan programs, the SELP program. There are a number of federal programs that are in flux at this point. I would have a few months ago talked to you about the production tax credit, but now it looks more like it's in investment tax credits and grants from a federal level. Those type of programs help build facilities. The green tags bring in another flavor, and what they do is when a project is up and running and generating power, as Stephen said, the green tags help provide operation and maintenance stability and provide funds to keep these projects going longer into the future. In summary, Korea supports 743 for a number of reasons. One is that a lot of them are community-based. They provide economics into irrigation districts and small communities, and the making them eligible for RECs like the larger utilities are helps provide them long-term stability. So thank you, Madam Chair and Committee.
Thank you. Go ahead, Mike.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Mike Kleinsmith. I manage Farmers Irrigation District in Hood River, Oregon. It's a local government special district founded in 1874. Provides water to about 5,800 acres of land and 1,722 water users. Members of our district grow mainly pears, apples, cherries, grapes, with an economic value of $80 million or more annually. Around 1980, we decided to put in two hydroelectric turbine generators into the irrigation infrastructure. The power plants have an installed capacity of 4.8 megawatts and produce enough electricity for over about 1,900 Oregon homes. Over the past 24 years, saved a considerable amount of CO2 emissions. And if the same power had been produced by coal, it would have emitted 193,000 tons of CO2. You know, this is it's an important bill. In 2010, our power sales contract is up, and we'll be losing considerable amount of money for to maintain our plants and to keep everything environmentally up to par. As far as Leahy goes, we're, I guess you'd call us the poster child for low-impact hydro. A few years ago, the board of directors determined it would be prudent to certify our project so that we could sell renewable energy credits to help support our plant and provide income for future environmental and other upgrades. So we applied for Leahy about a year ago. It's been a long process. It's fairly detailed and pretty complex. We have about 30 days left on a review period, and then we should find out if we qualify. We've worked closely with DEQ and Department of Fish and Wildlife and the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs to bring our plant standards up to the highest standards. We've also altered our operations to enhance steelhead and salmon populations and to reduce our impact on high summer water temperatures. while it's necessary, the work and expense, it was difficult for a small local government. And in the end, we recognize the benefits for the operation of our project, for our community, and for the environmental, and for the environment that these improvements provide.
Mr. Kleinsmith, since we have your written testimony, maybe if you can just summarize the key points.
We haven't gotten to Lehigh yet, but we're hoping that in the next 30 days. And I'd just like to say that without this extra funding from renewable energy certificates, it's going to be tough for us to keep our plants up to standards and do good things for fish and the environment. Thank you.
All right, thank you. And Mr. Mason, you appeared.
Chair Dingfelder, members of the Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee. For the record, my name is not Louis Pitt, and my apologies for that. He had to leave and attend to some business with Chief Delvis Heath. My name is also not Jim Mannion, though I'm here speaking on behalf of Mr. Mannion, who is the general manager of the Warm Springs Power and Water Enterprises. I guess I should say my name is Michael Mason.
Okay, so now we know who you are. Thank you.
That's insignificant as that is, because what's really important here is the passage of this bill, 743, which we're here to support. The folks who know the Deschutes River at all know about the Pelton Around Butte project. It was not designed with fish in mind or the communities downstream in mind. The tribes had to build a re-regulating dam in the 80s to make sure that the river didn't get scoured and that there wasn't further damage to fisheries. That was important, and it has an 18.5 megawatt capacity. It would be covered by this bill, and passage of the bill would allow the tribes to sell the wrecks for over $100,000. You may also be aware of the massive project that the tribes, PGE, ODF&W, Department of the Interior have undertaken to restore salmon and salmon fish passage upstream of Pelton Around Butte in the Upper Deschutes Basin. I've expended $102 million thus far on that. OWEB has committed another $2 million for habitat restoration in the Metolius Basin, and the money that the tribes could bring in from selling these wrecks would help with habitat restoration, particularly for salmon in the Deschutes proper and in the Crooked River. So it is very important to a major project in the heart of Oregon, and we appreciate your consideration and hope that you'll see fit to move the bill. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions for the panel? Down here? I guess I had one which the gentleman from Farmers Irrigation District sort of answered. You asked it and answered it in your testimony, but I thought it was important to get this on the record because I've had people ask me about this bill. Well, you can sell your wrecks nationally, so why is it important to have it qualify in Oregon? So I think if you want to try to...
Why I think it would be...
important to have it qualify for the RPS if you can sell those wrecks nationally with the Lehigh certification, which you said you're about to get.
Yeah. Well, hopefully we're about to get. We'll find out. So why nationally?
Well...
or why locally? Yeah, you're...
Okay, with the Lehigh certification, right, you can actually sell the wrecks, but now
right,
this bill would qualify for the RPS, so I think that distinction is important.
Well, I think eventually, probably in 2025, when local utilities need to be 25%, I think, renewable in their RPS, then I think that's important at that point to be able to sell locally. And I think if you nationally can sell your wrecks, then I think it's good to have let the rest of the nation support Oregon by buying our wrecks locally.
Okay. I don't know if either of you gentlemen want to respond. Or you both have Lehigh certification now, is that correct?
We do not.
Okay.
We're in process.
Okay.
Like Mike, he's further along,
okay,
though. I can do my best to answer your question.
Mm-hmm.
it's important to get the RPS eligibility because that links in with not only LEHI certification but also with Green E. And as the nation is developing a national approach to lower carbon emissions for whatever industries, including electric production, those are the steps that you have to follow through. So no one's required to buy these RECs that we would potentially be eligible for, but it's the certification steps and it's that potential, and the first step is becoming RPS eligible in that step.
Okay. All right. No further questions. We'll let these gentlemen go and we'll get the next group up here. Thank you very much, gentlemen, for coming. I know you came far away. We have Jeff Bissonette, Tony Barrows, Tom, and Suzanne Lenalu. I thought there was another Barrows that had sprouted.
You looked a little concerned.
It's like, there's a new one. Okay, Jeff, why don't you get started?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Bissonette, representing the Fair and Clean Energy Coalition. The Fair and Clean Energy Coalition is a statewide collaboration of consumer organizations, environmental groups, human service agencies, faith groups, clean energy businesses, and labor. We were involved in the passage of the Renewable Portfolio Standard last session and are very aware of a lot of the hesitancy to reopen the RPS, and members of our coalition, the Community Renewable Energy Association is a member of the coalition, as is Renewable Northwest Project, who you'll hear from in a minute, and so we're kind of trying to find the nice coalition approach to this. There is, I think, some sound policy reasons to have a discussion around this issue, and that's why we've entered into it. One is that we do have within the RPS allowed low-impact hydro-certified utility-owned resources. And so what this says is that, well, there are other non-utility hydro resources, and if they are also low-impact hydro-certified, then it makes sense to consider them. The proponents of the bill were also aware of the limitation that we had on the utility side, and they were willing to have a similar limitation on the non-utility owned side, and then it's a matter of the the RECs. I have to admit that going into this process, and this is still something I'm learning about, the renewable energy certificates have a value on a market, and there's a question on whether or not if a REC or renewable energy certificate has the same value if the project that it comes from is either qualifies for an RPS or not. And so I think that because that's an open question, it was, again, worthy of moving ahead with discussion on this issue. So I think from a policy point of view, we have a very narrow discussion around a very narrow set of issues around a very big topic of the RPS. And so that's so I think right now it's good to focus on, is this a good policy issue? And I think that there are some sound reasons to think that. And then if the committee wants to move ahead, there's a bunch of other issues kind of around the RPS, and we should take that up probably another hearing.
Okay. Tom?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Tom Barrows, representing Northern Wasco People's Utility District, small PUD up in the Dalles, Oregon. Here to discuss potential amendments. Northern Wasco has two low-impact hydro projects, one that began operation in May of 1991, so it doesn't qualify under the RPS, and another that began after 95 and does qualify. Very similar projects, but because of the timing, the date, the one that was an early adopter has been left out. We're in discussions with folks here because of the relating clause on this bill, looking at an amendment that might cap utility owned under 5 megawatts prior to 95 as an option. and so we're discussing that now. Discussed this with Mr. Bissonnette earlier, and he's going to talk to some folks and see if there's interest in us being able to pursue this. Wanted to let the committee know.
Thank you.
Hi, for the record, my name is Suzanne Lita-Lew. I'm the Senior Policy Advocate at Renewable Northwest Project. RNP is a coalition of public interest organizations, primarily consumer and environmental groups, and renewable energy companies and associated companies. We oppose 743, and we urge Madam Chair Dingfelder and the other committee members not to pursue this legislation further this session. The bill would alter SB 838, the 25% by 2025 renewable portfolio standard that was passed in 2007, by allowing for the inclusion of low-impact hydro projects built before 1995. The primary intent of SB 838 was to ensure that Oregon's ratepayers were getting increasing amounts of new renewable energy generation, and that's why the bill primarily excludes generation from facilities built before 1995. I should also note that SB 838 was a highly negotiated piece of legislation. There were multiple proposals on the table in 2007, and what we agreed to was what we thought, not just RNP, but consumer groups like Citizens Utility Board, utilities, the governor's office, state agencies. Well, we all agreed to the basic pieces of that bill because we believe that that was what we could negotiate to be in the best interest of the public and in the environment. After a year of rulemaking workshops and discussions in 2008 and 2009, the PUC is just now in the final stages of developing rules to implement the bill. And we feel strongly that the legislature should allow the PUC to finish the rules and proceed with implementation before considering any legislation to alter SB 838. I should also note that there are multiple bills that have been introduced at this session to alter SB 838. They include the addition of biomass built prior to 1995, a proposal to supplant energy efficiency with renewable energy, with the renewable energy standard in the bill. All of these proposals and many more were discussed in the 2007 session, and we, again, you know, we agreed to what we agreed to, and it was certainly a highly negotiated piece of legislation. I should also finally note that we certainly recognize the value of making investments in existing hydroelectric facilities to have those facilities be low-impact certified. But we also know that there are many other tools. The Federal Public Utility Regulatory Policies Act, which requires electricities to actually purchase power from small producers at avoided cost rates. We have a robust market for renewable energy credits and state incentives that help make sure that existing hydroelectric facilities have the tools that they need to make investments to be certified as low impact. So given those other policies, we don't believe that SB 838 is the right way to move forward. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Any questions?
What do you mean 743?
I'm sorry.
We're with you on that one.
Yeah, good. All right, excellent. We'll thank you. Sorry about that. Any questions for any of these panel members? Okay, thank you very much.
Just for the record, Madam Chair, you reminded me that there was also a letter submitted from the Portland Water Bureau regarding this, and it's in the members.
Okay, thank you. Is there anybody else who would like to testify in Senate Bill 743? Jan, why don't you come up? I am welcome.
Thank you. I'm Jan Lee, Executive Director of Northwest Hydro Association. Most of the utilities in the Northwest and Northern California are members, as well as irrigation districts, PUDs, and others. I just wanted to make a few comments. I've talked to our utility members, PGE, PacifiCorp, EWEB, and others, and they said that this was an oversight, that it was confined to utility-only hydro. And they are completely in support of not prohibiting non-hydro projects or non-utility hydro projects. The City of Portland has given you a letter. The City of Eugene is also in support. And as you look through that list of projects, most of them are public municipalities. And the dollars that will come from the RECs that they would be able to achieve will actually go back into public projects like water conservation in the districts, upgrades in the PUDs, et cetera. So we urge that you adopt this bill because it just makes a very minor fix, which was an unintended consequence, and it doesn't really open up the RPS to all of the other entities that don't have a national certification. The small hydro group is one of the few that does have a national certification program so that it can be justified to be a green renewable. And with that, I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Okay. Thank you, Jan.
Thanks.
Any questions? All right. Thank you. Okay. Anybody else that would like to testify on Senate Bill 743? Okay. Seeing none, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 743, and then we'll open up our public hearing on our last bill, Senate Bill 942. Beth?
Madam Chair and committee members, Senate Bill 942 requires the Department of Environmental Quality to create and implement the Oregon Climate Corps to place individuals throughout Oregon to work on efforts to address climate change.
Okay. And we have Sarah, is it Mazi? Mazie and Lila Hoagland. Oh, and Teddy Kaiser from Senator Berger's staff.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak today on this bill. My name is Teddy Kaiser from Senator Joanne Berger's office, and because we have a number of people that have come from out of town to speak on this bill, I'm going to forego most of my testimony, but other to point out a couple key elements. One is that there are Dash 1 amendments that you should have copies of, and we are in support of accepting the Dash 1 amendments that puts this in the extension services. Also to point out that this bill requires no funding, which is always an advantage in this building. So I wanted to point that out. But I'm also available for any questions that you may have.
Okay, thank you. Who'd like to go first?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sarah Mazie, and I work at the University of Oregon Climate Leadership Initiative. Mm-hmm. I am the program developer and program manager of the Climate Master Program, which would be authorized under Senate Bill 942, the Oregon Climate Corps Act. Oregon communities and businesses need climate change education and education around energy and resource efficiency. And the Climate Master Programs developed by the University of Oregon Climate Leadership Initiative and delivered by OSU Extension in partnership with our group are well poised to meet this challenge. They provide actionable education to support businesses, community members, and youth with strategies for resource and energy efficiency and other solutions for addressing climate change. The program is already up and running in several communities around the state, and there are more that are eager to implement the Climate Master Program. The University of Oregon Climate Leadership Initiative provides the content, while OSU Extension is well-suited to deliver the program with their expertise in volunteer management and similar program delivery with the Master Gardener Program and other master programs. There are three Climate Master programs at present: Climate Masters at Home, Climate Masters at Work for businesses, and Junior Climate Stewards, which is in development. The Climate Masters at Home program provides participants with 30 hours of training on energy and resource efficiency, and they then go out and do 30 hours of volunteer education and outreach. So there's a ripple effect, supporting others in saving energy and resources. Participants in that class and the people they've reached out to have reduced their annual greenhouse gas emissions by 2 tons per person, which is 10% of the national average, quite a bit in 1 year, and have saved 20% on their home energy bills. We do the same thing for businesses, but we ask the businesses that they do some implementation in their own workplace. And then, again, we're developing a program for youth that would support youth in school-based projects. The benefits of this program are that participants learn and practice strategies for energy and resource efficiency. They share those with others. It saves money for the participants and those they're doing outreach to. It's also good for communities that are likely to see benefits to public health as people are saving energy and with results in cleaner air and reduced traffic congestion. And finally, it positions Oregon businesses and communities to take the lead in a carbon-constrained economy. Thank you, and I'm ready for questions.
We'll go to Lila first. Hi, Lila.
Hi, nice to see you, Chair Dinkbelter and members of the committee. I'm Lila Hoaglam. I'm the Director of Special Initiatives for Oregon State University Extension Service. I appreciate the opportunity to testify before you today. I'm really here in order to support the partnership between the University of Oregon and Oregon State University Extension on this particular project. It is uniquely positioned for both of us to be involved in this project. The project, as Sarah indicated, does help Oregon residents reduce energy use, consumption patterns, greenhouse gas emissions, and it is patterned after some of the master programs, which I'm sure you're very familiar with, like the Master Gardener Program, the Wildlife Stewards Program, and others around the state of Oregon. The U of O Climate Leadership Initiative developed this program and is really not in a position to deliver the program across the state of Oregon, but Extension is uniquely positioned for that. It is positioned for that because we have Extension offices, as you may know, in every county in the state. We also, as you may know, deliver research-based educational programs that address issues of importance to local people across the state of Oregon. OSU Extension is, in fact, uniquely qualified and positioned to deliver this kind of a program because we work well with many, many volunteers. OSU Extension has around 20,000 trained volunteers employed across the state of Oregon to deliver educational programs in a number of different topics. We know how to manage volunteer programs. We have the county office infrastructure in place and already established. We are familiar with the train-the-trainer model, which helps us expand our ability to reach out to Oregonians across the state. And Extension, in fact, reaches about a third of the population of the state of Oregon right now through a variety of other programs that we're involved in. So this partnership between OSU and the University of Oregon Climate Leadership Program really is a perfect match. The U of O has developed the curriculum for the program so far and has modified the curriculum and is very open to input on the curriculum. And we have provided some of that as we've begun to deliver the program. OSU, on the other hand, is much better suited for delivery of the program. There is one section in the bill, which is Section 2, that talks a bit about creating a fund to place resources for the program. And one of the things I would point out is that University of Oregon and Oregon State University both have systems in place and mechanisms in place to both accept and manage resources. And so you may want to think about that one as the bill proceeds. But let me just conclude by saying that energy conservation, efficiency, and reducing carbon footprint is, in fact, important to all Oregonians. And I ask your support of Senate Bill 942 as we, the two institutions, work together to find ways to fund and implement the program for the benefit of Oregonians. So thank you very much for the opportunity to testify, and I'd be happy to respond to any questions that you have.
Okay, thank you. Questions? Okay, Senator Hess.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I very much support the intention. I just wonder if this could be done without legislation, without a law.
Chair Dinkfelter and Senator Hess, I believe that it can be, in fact, is being administered without a law, without official legislation. I think what the legislation does is it formalizes the program, it formalizes the partnership, it creates visibility for the program that perhaps it would not have in other ways, and it might also create the kind of visibility that we need in order to acquire the funding that's necessary to actually implement the program.
Thank you.
Okay, and a follow-up to Senator Hass's question, because Section 2, the Oregon Climate Corps Fund, is established in our Treasury, so now, you said there's no fiscal. Two questions I have. I'm going to sound like Senator Boquist now. This says that the Oregon State University Extension Service shall develop a long-term plan to fund the Oregon Climate Corps program. So does that mean that you would absorb those costs because you're already doing that? I mean, I'm trying to figure out how there's no fiscal on the amendment. And we haven't gotten the actual fiscal analysis back, but I'm just going off of... what Mr. Kaiser said.
Yeah, Chair Dingfelder, what we're doing right now is we're simply looking for potential grant funds or other funding sources and are using fees in order to pay for the program. We're really not in a position to roll out the program statewide, however, without some additional resources. We would hope that those resources could be found through private sources initially, until we at least get the program implemented more and can begin to generate some fees and look for other potential sources of funding in order to implement the program more broadly throughout the state.
Okay. All right. Follow-up. I was going to say a question for Senator Boquist, but somehow I have a feeling it's going to be a follow-up to the question I asked.
Yes, Madam Chair, it is. a lot of the things I see in here are things we should be doing. Don't disagree with that, but in the three terms I've been here, the first two terms have been bloody in terms of trying to even get OSU Extension Service funded, and you know we've gone through that cycle again now, and I'm not quite sure how I guess I don't grasp. I mean, I'm concerned about the fiscal, and I guess more of a statement than a follow-up, Madam Chair, is that fiscal I'm concerned about, because those of us on the ag side are fighting constantly just to try and get it, and good share has helped us before in the past in the ways and means process where we've managed to come up with funds, but extension funds are always on the forefront of being cut. So,
would anybody like to comment on that before we pull up the
Madam Chair and Senator Boquist? One of the aspects of this program is that people who want to be part of the program then pay a fee to be trained in these issues. So there's funding in that way, but it's not from the legislature. It's from people who want to participate in the program. And then also, there are other avenues. That's why we wanted the fund to be able to take funds from other areas. For example, the AmeriCorps has expressed interest in this program. They're going to have tripling in their federal budget in 2010. So they've been interested in helping fund the program. So there's other areas where we can find funds besides the general fund. So this is really more to formalize the program so that we can accept funds in the future from these various different outlets.
Okay. Thank you very much. Any other questions, Senator Boquist? Thank you.
Okay.
And we've got some other folks signed up that would like to testify. Bob, did you want to come up?
No.
Okay. Teresa Brand. Cecile
Thurko.
And Jocelyn Shiner. Okay. Welcome. I'd like to start off, please, and please state your name for the record.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Teresa Brand, and I'm here to urge your support for SB 942, which supports the establishment of Climate Corps Climate Masters under that act. I became familiar with the program while attending graduate school at the University of Oregon. That was the first session of Climate Masters as it was being developed. Went through the program and subsequently made a lot of changes in my personal life, a lot of behavior changes of having learned a lot of different things about my personal impacts and the way I use water and home energy, the way I get my food and the distance it travels, etc. So it actually just had a real impact on me. At the conclusion of the class, I had an opportunity to work with OSU Extension and bring a pilot program to Corvallis, which we worked with OSU Extension and brought the first program as part of this new partnership.
If you could just, the mic's very sensitive, so you don't have to be very close
gotcha.
To it. Yeah.
Okay.
We can hear you better that way. Thank
okay,
you.
Sorry. Anyway, I was felt so strongly about the value of the program, having been through it, that was assisted with it coming to OSU Extension to the city of Corvallis. And we had a program that happened this last winter, which was sponsored by the University of Oregon and OSU Extension. And in the class, we had people such as the mayor's wife, some school teachers, concerned community members, students, all working together through the different activities and information, learning more both about their impacts and also ways that they could talk to their neighbors about perhaps changing their behavior around their climate impacts. So again, very personal one-on-one program offered on a community level, having a lot of widespread impacts, and I hope will really change the footprint of City of Corvallis because this program was able to roll out into the Corvallis and Benton County area. In the future, my hope is that you'll support the passage of this bill, establish the program Climate Masters, so that program can be basically brought out throughout the state through the Extension Service. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello, and thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify today. For the record, my name is Jocelyn Champagne Shiner, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm a Climate Master volunteer. I've been trained to help the people of my community realize energy efficiencies and to make a positive impact on climate change. And I'm here to tell you a few things about the program and why I think it's so wonderful. The program offers concise information and proven strategies. It includes existing resources and a summary of references and recommendations for each of five areas of focus. I like that the home consultations are flexible. They can be brief or long, and a flexible protocol is the key. We hone in on what's important to the participant. With the program, the in-depth research has been done for you, and the consultation literally brings it to your doorstep. We strive to give unconditional positive regard while demonstrating hands-on techniques, which leads to lifelong learning and behavior change. The consultation participants I found so far are really ready to embrace change, and they're ready to feel that they're in control of this aspect of their lives. So many things right now are not under their control. They're also eager to be validated for their current efforts. They want to become educated, instructed, and they become empowered to go forward and sign that action plan. While scientifically backed and outcomes-oriented, the program provides encouragement without intimidation and inclusive support without guilt, and I think that's excellent, and that's the recipe for success. So with this philosophy, the Climate Master Program leads by example while admitting our own shortcomings as we try to progress to becoming masters. I think most importantly, the program sparks discussion and increases awareness of how one individual can make a difference and just how many resources are at the ready to provide assistance on that journey. The program made a huge difference in my life as well. I'll just go into a few things. What is there to gain? Well, with active transportation, I've actually gained muscles, energy, and joy. I said in my class before that riding over the Willamette River on the bike path is pure joy. Small changes, using a microwave to boil a cup of water for tea rather than my kettle, small. Large questions, what appliance do I buy? I just recently bought a refrigerator. Can I improve on my energy actions? Yes, because this program taught me how. The consultations result in a tailored program for each individual participant based on meeting them where they are for their needs and their desires, expounded on by the volunteer consultant and backed by the expertise of the program. The benefits to the climate and the participant are immediate and don't require large investments of money, but rather commitments to changes in behaviors and habits. The action plan gives directions and measurable goals, which we need, and the sense of community and empowerment is heightened, the enthusiasm contagious. So the Climate Master Program, for me, has proven itself worthy of continuation and expansion and seems to be an excellent fit for Senate Bill 942. I support it. Thank you for giving me a moment to testify.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Cecily Thurko. I am a fall 2008 graduate of the Climate Masters at Home program that's sponsored by the Climate Leadership Initiative in Eugene, Oregon, and I support SB 942. I am a product of the well-organized and insightful training from the Climate Masters at Home program. It changed my life and impacts every decision I make about energy and resource use. Before the training, I was not fully aware of the impact of my day-to-day decisions had on my carbon footprint and my inefficient use of energy and resources. And as a result of the training, I have now the tools and the knowledge to evaluate and modify my energy and resource use and have embraced the changes I can. I am not done yet, but the small changes have reaped rewards to my pocketbook. And I take advantage of the rebate programs and tax incentives for energy reduction that have been afforded to us through information from the Climate Masters program. The program itself and the training was a catalyst to action for me, and I volunteer in the community to spread the word about energy and resource management. I believe that focused education is the key to preparing Oregonians for future energy and resource management decisions. The Climate Masters program is the means. Offering the program statewide is a crucial step in satisfying that need, and it's a good fit to SB 942. Thank you.
Thank you, ladies, for coming here today. Are there any questions? Okay. Thank you very much for sharing your testimony. We have a couple more folks signed up. Bailey Payne. Is Bailey here? There you go. And Maggie Lipsay. Oh, and we actually have Alice Warner. I might as well call you all up because we do have four chairs. And Kathleen Joy. Is Kathleen here? Okay. Bailey, why don't you get started? It's good to see you.
Great. It's good to see you as well. And I'd like to thank the chair, Madam Chair, and the committee for having me here to talk in support of Senate Bill 942. My name's, for the record, Bailey Payne, and I recently took the Climate Masters at Home class, which was offered in Corvallis. And I just had a wonderful experience. I learned a tremendous amount, and I think one of the real strengths of this class is that what's come out of it now are the payback hours that I'm just starting to do. And it's really just these conversations, neighbor to neighbor, just kind of helping friends and family to reduce their carbon emissions through making efficiencies in their home and transportation choices. So it's been an outstanding class, and really Senator Boquist had asked earlier about the cost of it, and I know personally I would have paid quite a bit more than what I was charged for the class because I'm already seeing some energy savings from my utility bills, and so I would have been willing to pay a higher cost knowing that I'm going to, in the long run, learn skills that are going to bring down my utility bills. I work for Marion County as a recycling coordinator and teach a master recycler class, which is similar to these. And I've also taken another master class offered by OSU Extension. And one thing that I've really seen firsthand is that we're experiencing an unprecedented level of interest in our classes. And so that's encouraging, and it gives me hope that this would be something that would be well received throughout Oregon, beyond just the major cities that it's been offered in up to this point. Another thing that I've seen in our Master Recycler program is that it was developed kind of piecemeal throughout the state, offered by a variety of different agencies. And one of the strengths of this bill, I think, is that by having the leadership under the University of Oregon's Extension Service, the University of Oregon Climate Leadership Initiative and the OSU Extension Service, that they would really bring some continuity to the program, and so it would give it a more consistent delivery. And I think that these two organizations really have three key strengths. They have expertise in delivering high-quality education. They're reputable. They're science and research-based education. And they have a tremendous reach. OSU Extension has an office in every county, and they've already made tremendous inroads with people of rural backgrounds and throughout Oregon. And in conclusion, I'd like to say that I think that education is a simple and voluntary, encouraging these voluntary behavior changes are one of the most inexpensive ways that we can really see some significant reductions in climate changing gases. Thank you.
Thank you. You can just slide that over, one of those.
Thank you for letting me testify today, Madam Chair and the committee. My name is Maggie Livesey, and can you hear that?
Yep.
All right. I am a 4-H youth development faculty at Oregon State University Extension Service, and I'm a resident of Oregon for 20 years and have worked for the Extension Service in a variety of natural resource education programs over the years. I'm here today both as a private citizen who took the Climate Masters class and as an OSU Extension Service faculty member. I want to say that when I took the class, I'm similar, Bailey and I were in the same class, and I have to say I was very impressed with the research that went into this class. The curriculum is excellent, is well thought out. In fact, it at times was a lot to absorb. There's a lot of information around climate change and greenhouse gas emissions that I think is confusing to people, I think it needs to be simplified for people and delivered to them in these volunteer-type programs, these master programs. We do a lot of these at the Extension Service, and the one-on-one interactions that we have in, as part of the programs, you really see true behavior change from people as a result of their participation. At our house, we've always lived really moderately. We drive fuel-efficient cars. We combine our rides to town. We recycle. We reuse. You know, you think you're doing everything that you can do. And after I took the class, I realized that there were some misconceptions that I had. For instance, we just put in brand new windows, and I was really excited to get vinyl windows put in because I was sure that then I could feel really good about the energy loss out of our house. After I took the class, I went, oh, you know, you need insulations. I have a 1959 house. I need insulation in the walls. That should be the first big step, not the windows. The windows are the aha because you look through them all the time. But that's not really what the most energy savings was in. So I think for me, things like that, little things like a lot of people talked about, just shifted the way that I thought about my own greenhouse gas emissions and our family as well. I also believe that the OSU Extension Service is a great place to deliver educational programs like this. I agree, you know, with Senator Boquist that we've had the funding sometimes in the last many years. Extension's been on the cutting block or the chopping block. And I would encourage any of you who have not visited an Extension office, come down to ours. We are nonstop action with people coming in the door all the time. Huge volunteer programs, and like Bailey said, an increase in the number of volunteers that are coming to us. Don't know what to say about that in terms of funding. I'm just, come visit if you want to see what it's really like.
Been to mine many times.
Yeah, I've been. Which ones have you been to?
Polk County.
Okay, well, how about, maybe it's the ones you're choosing to go to. How about that?
No, they're great. I think your misconception, what we're talking about is we're the ones up here fighting all the time to get money for the Extension Service.
Right.
And we're the ones that get in the political battles trying to get you money.
Right. Well, I apologize. Okay.
So if you could wrap up, please, because we've got a couple more folks.
Okay.
I'm going to lose people in about 4 minutes.
Okay. I can just finish up. I just encourage you to support the 942. And I'll stop.
Great. Thank you.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Alice Warner, and I'm here to support Senate Bill 942. I think it's an excellent bill. It's forward-thinking. To me, it looks like a good help for Oregonians of all incomes and Oregon businesses to adapt to changing economic conditions, and I think it'll help build healthy Oregon communities. So I'm here to encourage you to move the bill out of committee and into a work session. I've been an attorney for more than 20 years and a public servant for 22 plus, and I'm also a certified Oregon teacher. I'm here today because I was a volunteer. I've been a volunteer climate master, was trained in the first session, but then I also was the staff coordinator for the session last fall. So a number of the people who were here were in the class that I coordinated. So it makes me feel good to see them doing what they signed up to do, which is spreading information about energy efficiency. So I wanted to make 4 points and focus a little bit on the connection to the extension, which I think is vital. But the 4 big points I wanted to just make are, one, this kind of environmental education is a good fit for your bill, and it's an important bill because it gives people practical and useful information about how to save energy and use it wisely. This saves money for us as individuals, but it also saves money for our community. And we, in the class, we bring in people from EWEB and other utilities, and they talk about how when we save money, when we save energy individually, we can also reduce the amount of power the community needs to generate and plan for. And that's very, very important as we support Oregon businesses and communities in the future. I've worked with people through this program on we're all talking about very small changes that actually, when you add them all up, make a huge difference. One of the first clients I work with had an aha moment in the first 5 minutes and decided to give up bottled water. This is a woman I see in the store about every few months. Every time she sees me, she tells me another thing she's thought of doing, which is saving her money. And she sees me now as a sort of
energy ambassador. She wants to share that information with me. I'm just a volunteer. I just said I'd like to get the information and share it with you. It's had a profound impact on this woman's life, and I could give you many other stories. But it starts with something very simple, like I'm not going to drink bottled water anymore. And then it gets to further and further and deeper and deeper. The second point I wanted to make is that this, through this program, we can good environmental education, we can connect people to programs that are already out there and strengthen existing programs. The OSU Extension in Lane County has started an exciting new program supporting sustainable landscaping by homeowners, and they're going to be moving that into also training commercial landscapers in sustainable practices. I and a number of other climate masters participated and supported that first round of training, and that adds to the extension's existing base, traditional master gardener programs, canning and preserving programs, excellent 4-H and youth programs. To me, this feels like a program that can bring the extension along, expand it, and help it connect to the community where the community's at now, bringing the traditional expertise of the extension into a new light and making sure that we harness those skills and we connect young people and new people consistently to our master gardeners and some of our extremely strong existing programs. Third point I just wanted to make is that this we shouldn't forget that this program helps Oregonians become more physically active. When we talk about walking or we talk about riding your bike, talk about doing more things in your yard and your garden, we're talking about using calories instead of taking the electricity out of the wall. When I grow flowers, I grow my own fruit, or I walk around my neighborhood, I meet my neighbors, I'm expending calories and I'm healthier. And given what's happening with kids and families today, I think that's really important to think about. Last point is just that this kind of environmental education and the other things in your bill where we talk about carbon sequestration projects, energy efficiency projects, this is about bringing Oregonians together around a positive goal. This is a fearful time. Change often brings fear. But this bill, to me, speaks of inspiring each other, supporting each other, helping Oregonians develop new skills, and helping them access existing knowledge. That, to me, is turning that fear into hope and joy. And that's what the program's been for me, and I hope you extend it and support it.
Okay. Thank you. Kathleen?
For the record, my name is Kathleen Joy. I'm the director of Oregon Volunteers, the Commission for Voluntary Action and Service. You're getting some printed material about how this program might fit in with the President's new clean energy course, which is what I came to talk about. But taking off my AmeriCorps hat and putting on my volunteer hat, cheerleading for volunteerism, I would tell you that we are very strong partners with OSU Extension. It doesn't sound like there's a need for AmeriCorps at this point, but in this packet you'll have information about what the new Climate Corps might look like from the AmeriCorps point of view and how things might roll out over the next couple years. So I'll end there.
Okay, great. This is very helpful because that was a question that I had, was how would this fit in with AmeriCorps? So I'll take a look at this. Any questions for these last witnesses? Okay, well, thank you very much for coming here today. We appreciate you all coming to share your thoughts on this bill. Anybody else that would like to testify on this bill, Senate Bill 743? With that, then, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 743. Close the Senate Environment.
Action 943.
Oh, I'm sorry. I will close the public hearing on 942. I was reading the wrong number. And with that, I will close the Senate Environment and Natural Resources.